Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Scots Wha Hae podcast. And I'm joined today by Greg and Pat Kane, otherwise known as Hugh and Cry. Hello, both.
Hi, man. How you doing?
I'm
really good. And we're here to talk about your 40th anniversary celebrations, which are happening throughout the year. Well, first of all, congratulations and a happy anniversary. How does it feel to be doing what you do for that long? Pat, if you answer first.
It feels, frankly, a wee bit weird when you think about what such a large chunk of your lifespan that is. Really, I mean, maybe half, maybe less than half. I don't know. It depends how things go. I think it feels like there's a theory that the writer Malcolm Gladwell talks about in a book Outliers. He talks about the 10,000 hours rule. And the thing about the 10,000 hours really applies it. He applies it to Bill Gates. He applies it to sportsmen and all manner of people. But it's sort of like if you've been trying to master a craft for more than up to or more than 10,000 hours, and no matter what anybody says about you, whether no matter anybody's value judgment on you, you kind of know what you're doing.
Yeah.
So that's one of the ways I've been thinking about these 40 years is that we're probably both amassed. Greg's probably got more hours in than I have, but certainly I would say we're over 20,000 hours between us, and so therefore it's looking back on a history of trying and trying again, and succeeding and failing, experimenting, creating. So I'm very, very proud of it.
Yeah.
But I'm proud of it on that basis, and I think which is that we've created a year of celebrating 40 years, which because of digital archive and digital platforms and Gregory's heavy labours, we're able to show people what a creative life looks like over four decades. And I look back on it and I'm amazed that there are like entire albums that we made and we didn't bring out. Tracks that I think, why wasn't that a single, et cetera, et cetera. But I think by luck and by, I think, a wee bit of self-discipline, we've managed to kind of show ourselves to be, it's been a very worthwhile 40 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And Greg, before we started recording, you said that basically what you do is practice the piano and, you know, maybe, you know, learn the new tech and stuff like that. So that's right. What Pat's saying is those kind of hours, you've put them in.
Yes, we have put them in. Doesn't seem to get any better though. It's like it's a bit like being a golfer. You get to sort of about 11 under and it doesn't seem to get any better. I got to 11 under playing golf for very, really quickly. And I spent 6 years beating myself up because I couldn't get any. That was it. It must be quite, I don't know. Do you get to a point where you realise that's as good as you're ever going to get at something? That's it. You can't get any better no matter how much more you practice, how much more. I mean, at the moment in our archive, as Pat said, we're releasing stuff every month from a different era. It's 40 years divided into 12 months.
Yeah.
So if you're interested, 40 divided by 12 is 3.333333333. I know that. But what was I talking about there? I've completely forgot what the golf analogy. I've been thinking about playing
golf. Do you reach a point where you feel any better?
Well, I'm at
this means you maybe reached a really great point.
But the era I'm at now is between 1996 and 1999 when Pat and I signed to Lynn Records, which is one of the most, or the biggest, not the biggest, the best sounding jazz label in the world, Lynn. So we were chuffed to bits. And then our first album's got the Brecker Brothers on it. It's got Danny Gottlieb on it. It's got Miles Davis's guitarist, Mike Stern, on our first jazz album. And I was listening to the stuff that I'm mastering and I practiced for hours because there was no way I was going to get on a stage with these guys and not be able to look them straight in the eye, because jazz is all about virtuosity and it's all about, there's a lot of bullying goes on in jazz. You have to be strong and you have to be quite aware of your surroundings. So I wasn't going to, I mean, there's a gig I've just mixed from the Birmingham Jazz Festival in 1999. Goodness me, we were playing our asses off, Pat. But you had to raise your bar. But once we came out of the jazz phase, you know, when we kind of resurfaced again in the sort of mid, late 2000s, you know, I hadn't practiced like I used to practice. So with playing jazz, you have to keep doing it. you need to practice every 2 hours, at least two hours a day, at least. So I kept that regime going. So it got to the stage where, I mean, now the technology that I've got to deal with, when Pat and I play live now, I'm sitting looking at the setup now because I practice it every day. So I bring, like, there's a bit, synthesizers, pianos, the whole thing. And it has to become second nature to you. You have to just, without even looking, reach for a knob or a fade that I know exactly what it's going to do. And that only comes with repetition. But so you have to have a kind of regime of practice and dedication, which after 40 years, I can't believe I still have. There's some days I come in here and think, what have I got to do today? Oh, shit, I don't know how to do that. Then you spend an hour on YouTube and you go and you write things down. You go, right, I need to do this. So it never seems to change for me. And then once I get frustrated, I go and sit and play the piano, and then I'll play a wrong chord in a song and go, wait a minute, that's really good. And I'll write it down and I'll play it to Pat at the next sound. And I go, that's a great, where'd that chord come from? I said, I don't know, I made a mistake, but I tried to remember it. So that it's just constantly feeding into your head of things that you have to do, even the mistakes.
And how do you work together? Is it as simple as Greg, music, Pat, words? Is it like that, or is this more complicated?
Pretty much like that. We're both sounding boards for each other. So, I mean, I won't write the words, but I'll kind of try and steer Pat in a direction. It's usually if I don't fully understand what he's trying to sing about initially, I'll probably sometimes steer it the wrong directions, but we know how to give each other a space. Pat's a great sounding board. He's not a playing musician.
Yeah.
If I can sense by his body language if it's working for him.
I have a very strong memory. The strongest writing memory I have, three of them really. One of them is sitting in a London studio with a silly wee beatbox and a piano and expected to write songs when we come up with Labour of Love. The second one is sitting in a place called Savar where we were writing and we came up with Looking for London. I remember that scenario very well. And then the most recent writing that we've done, which is for this electronic record we're bringing out in 2025. And what's the same about all of them is him and me in a room with bits of usable technology. And we're just reacting to each other. So I might bring a melody along, Gregory might bring a whole riff along or a set of chords or a new drum machine or a new synthesizer or sequencer or arpeggiator or whatever it is. And I think that's why, another reason why we've been at this for 40 years is because the creative inspirations come from so many different angles. I mean, sometimes I've got a lyric that has a certain mood and has a certain metaphor and I can hear him responding to the metaphor.
Right.
And I can hear him responding to the mood. And vice versa. You know, Gregory lays something down and I've written out this carefully planned set of lyrics, and because he's written something down and goes a certain way, I have to go with it, that mood of I have to change the whole lyric on the fly, on a notepad on my knee, right there and then and now, otherwise we don't catch it. So it's not like Bernie Taupin and Elton John or something, you know, there's no first formalized relationship between lyrics and melody and song and music. I mean, it's properly dynamic, and I think that's again, that has to be the secret of our whatever our success is or our longevity or our persistence is that we don't, and we always, there's always a possibility that we'll genuinely excite each other with something that's coming along. And that's fantastic.
Just so you mentioned Elton John there, Pat. I've found in our archive a piece of article and I'm reading it and I go, why is this? Why have you got this? And I'm reading the article and it's a review of an Elton John gig. From years ago, from the 90s. And I'm reading down, and the third last paragraph in the reviewer says, I thought it was a little bit unfair that when Elton came on from his encore, he said the most, his band and him hated Hue and Cry more than any other band. And I've never seen any Elton John in my life. And the thing is, I showed it to Pat the next day in the tour bus. He says, I couldn't believe this. So it's in the archive, so you can read this review of an Elton John gig, and at the end of it, he says, from the stage, my band and I hate Hue and Cry so much.
But a few months before, this is the danger of digging up an archive for 40 years. My explanation for this is a few months before Q Magazine, for their 100th edition, did an article on us where they offered us £10 to break up because we were the most hated band in Britain. So I think Elton was just being a lazy twit and copying what was regarded as rock orthodoxy at the time. But you know, if you're annoying people that much, Alistair, you must be doing something right. We must be doing something that's worthwhile if it's going to get up Elton John's beak that way. So Elton John, but there we are.
The last thing I'm thinking about when I go back on for an encore is how much I hate other bands. Just think about that.
What's the point? Anyway,
did that stuff, you know, because you've been going all this time, and then you know you've had success, a critical success, and then you get something like that, which you know, it must affect you, you know, to be kind of, but not so much Elton John. That's just bizarre. But a Q magazine or kind of journalists, kind of you know, doing stunts like that, if you like.
It's not been helped by the fact I once wrote an article for The Guardian in 1993, whereas the first paragraph was rock criticism is an oxymoron, because the best critique of a piece of music is to say, I can do better than that, that's not good enough, that's all right, but I can improve it. So that's the best form of rock criticism, is more music, musicians responding to other musicians. Second paragraph of the article, and most rock critics are poxy morons.
But you think that because probably quite a few is out of joint.
So, you know what I mean? You kind of make your bed and you kind of lie in it. But I think I was a rock critic before I was a musician, yeah. And I knew them all in London, and they all knew me. So, you know, we didn't enter, you know, should I have written that piece? No, I shouldn't have written that piece. That was the wrong piece to write. But so Hue and Cry have always annoyed the rock critic elite, because we give better justifications for our music than they could ever give of our music.
Yeah.
More intelligent. Gregory's more musical. I'm more aware of what I'm putting into the lyrics. Do you know what? Not here we are at 40.
Yeah.
You know, many of the magazines who criticized us no longer exist. So who won out in that tussle? You know?
Yeah.
It's quite interesting. I've been archiving a lot of the press. The first episode of our 40-year celebration is 84 to 85. So there's not much. In fact, there's no press in there. The next one coming up is 1986. So there's some bits and bobs. There's some stuff. And then the next one, I don't want to kind of spoil it for everybody, 1987. Yeah, you can sense the journalists getting a little bit apprehensive before the interview, Pat and I. There's always like, just because I've read them all, opening paragraphs, sort of trying to kind of set themselves up to deal with Pat Kane. The guys that kind of stepped up, John Williamson did well with you, Pat. He was fit for you. Yeah. Tom Morton was fit for you too. But there's a few of them you can sense in Pat's. Stuart Cosgrove was up for you, but you gave him a run for his money every time he interviewed us. But when you read some of these interviews, especially as I say, 1987 episode 3, you'll kill yourself laughing. These poor journalists just crumble.
But you see, the thing is, Alistair, one of the things that people say, what does 40 years mean? And I've just been saying this maybe a bit repetitively, but we're post-punks.
Yeah.
Punks, recording the truth. Post-punk, all the chords and all the truths. Post-punk, let's make a hit record out of all that. So all the attitude from the punk, it was expected from the punk in the post-punk era that you had an attitude that you had a political attitude, or you had an aesthetic attitude that was high and mighty, that was taking a flamethrower to everything. So yeah. I'm a wee bit of a creature of my time in that respect. And I was also a great student of people like Malcolm McLaren and Paul Morley and ZTT, you know, where they would go into the mainstream, but they would bring troubling, disturbing things in. You know, Withdraw My Labour of Love. I mean, what, you know, did Arthur Scargill write that song or what? You know, so you're constantly bringing elements from the world of power and money and struggle and asymmetry and injustice, you know, into the heart of your interview with somebody from Smash Hits. It's not going to go well. You know, it's not going to go well.
I mean, you know, I read a lot of your interviews at the time as well, and they were always interesting because you referenced things other than just music. You brought in books, you brought in film and all of those things, which as a young guy, you're like, oh, I'm going to go and check that out. So you were kind of influencing people beyond the music.
That's the dream, Alistair. That's what. But it really annoys the critical classes. You know, that's what, exactly what I thought we were doing with the artwork on the albums, with the references, with quotes all over the place. I thought we were involved in a kind of, in the way that you would want to be involved in a young music consumer's life, to expand horizons. In the way that when you listen to Ian Dury and the Blockheads, Do It Yourself, or David Bowie's Low, or Empires and Dance by Simple Minds, your mind was blown. You want to blow people's minds, and why not the cognitive and intellectual part of their minds, as well as the emotional and dancing part of their minds, you know?
Yeah,
you know.
Absolutely. And we should let people know exactly what to expect throughout the year. Greg, you've already mentioned, you know, you've got clippings and cuttings, and it sounds like you've got a huge archive to work through. You kind of kept everything, is that right?
We kept everything. The story that I tell is, at our studio here in Maryhill in Glasgow, throughout the years we've been here, boxes have started to appear of our archive at different times. So house moves, or management offices moves, or old record companies closing down and contacting us, or studios closing down. That was a big influx of a lot of this archive, when the studios we'd worked at, God bless them, had contacted us and said, look, the studio's but it's gone, can't do anymore, but we've got shelves of your stuff. Would you want to come and get it? So it kind of built up, and then when lockdown happened, I was kind of in here. I had a pretty tough lockdown. It didn't work out that well for me, sort of up here and other places, and I was frustrated at myself because I didn't make the most of it. So I was looking for stuff to do. I wasn't being that creative. I wasn't being that successful being creative. So I learned how to do stuff. I studied stuff, and I kept looking at these boxes and CDRs. I thought, I'll need to have a look at this. But I didn't have a cassette player. A lot of them are cassettes. So I bought a cassette player off eBay, set it all up. And then one day, I put my hand in a box and I picked out a cassette, and it said, Wembley, Thursday. That's all it said on it. So I thought, Wembley, Thursday. So I put it in. And I thought, surely this is not Pat and I playing Wembley Stadium with Madonna on Thursday, the something of August in 1987. And that's what it was.
Wow.
It was unbelievable. Somebody must have recorded it from the desk. It was probably Hutch, your old sound engineer, so God knows why I had it. And it was brilliant. And it was the sound of four or five guys. It was five of us, wasn't there, in that band from Glasgow. I mean, so high. Not drunk or stoned or on drugs, but so high in adrenaline in front of 60,000 people in Wembley Stadium. And you could, it was just blasting out speakers to me. So I kind of ingested it, and I started restoring it. And then I started going through the rest of it, finding recordings that I didn't use, songs that I didn't even know. I've got a whole series of songs that you've not heard yet, Pat, called dictaphone songs. There's the ones that I'm a wee dictaphone, I think you bought me for my Christmas. And I just put it down when we were recording or writing or playing. And there's hours of this stuff. I mean, I'm not going to release it all. I've kind of curated it, if you know what I mean. I can't. But even being curated, there's over 200 pieces of music. There's over 150 newspaper clippings and magazine clippings. And there's over 150 photos. So I'm going to spread them out throughout the year. And I'm still finding stuff. I mean, the first episode's already been released. And then I found more stuff. So we're doing four EPs a month from this massive archive. And then we're also doing a documentary, a 10-minute documentary, Pat and I talking about each era that corresponds to those four-track EPs. And then there was so much stuff. We built a Patreon site that's going to host the rest of it. And some of the stuff's free on there. Some of the stuff's behind a paywall. We'll just see how it goes. I've never really built anything like this before. But so far, so good. People are engaging with it. And so there's a home for all this stuff. So it'll be when I first started it, I wanted the Hue and Cry fans to get involved.
Yeah.
And even just this morning, there's a Hue and Cry fan sent me an email through the Patreon site. And he's like, Greg, I don't think the mastering of Here Comes Everybody, which your first single, is good enough. Maybe your source material wasn't good enough. I digitized it about 10 years ago. Here's the files. I thought, cheeky bastard. Fine. But I went to Pro Tools this morning and I AB'd him. He's right. I went, oh, fuck, can he do that again before it's released? So this is the kind of collaboration I was looking for. I mean, I took that off a record that I bought on eBay for 64 quid because I didn't have a copy of Here Comes Everybody. I had 64 quid, spent that, got the record, went into Rubber Dub, transferred it. It sounded okay. It wasn't that good. I thought it was like the way it was originally mastered. But this fans put my hands up. What can I do?
And you've released the first two EPs already, aren't they? They're out, I think, Beginnings and the Exposure. And their demos, aren't they? They're kind of going back to kind of early, or these are anyway. I don't know if they'll continue that way, but these are early.
First ones, because, well, up to Here Comes Everybody is the thing that I'm talking about, which has already been released. It sounds fine. It's just this one sounds a wee bit better, so it'll be all right. That was a single release, but there was only ever 1,000 made. And I remember a story, so it was 1986, beginning of 1986. My mum, they were sitting in the house, and mum, not all of them, but a lot of them, and my mum was a district midwife, and she would put 10 of them in her bag and go out and hand them out to people. See, this is my boys. So she used to kind of look after, deliver wains and promote her boys' music. Yeah. Remember that?
See, my not with official Scottish NHS permission, I don't think, but anyway.
Well, now the people who are bedbound and saying you've got to listen.
Yeah, they've got no choice.
you mentioned like finding a recording of you playing supporting Madonna. Do you ever look back and think, was that us? I mean, you know, a lot of the things that you've done have been huge, absolutely huge.
I mean, the regret is a terrible emotion. You know, so do I regret in that Wembley Stadium snubbing George Michael's entreaty to say hello and have a conversation with me? Because I thought, I don't talk to the likes of George Michael. Yes. So yeah. it's a terrible emotion. What I like about it is that, you know, we have gone from a position of being, there's a song we do called Goodbye to Me, a pretty little poppet with the strings in that are in my own hand is kind of one of the lines from it. So, you know, you're watching two guys who just threw themselves into the business, signed what they signed, you know, were ripped off to the extent they were ripped off as everybody else was, because that's the way the music business was then. And it's a climb towards self-autonomy and self-determination and self-mastery. And it goes right through all these kind of endeavors. Also, what I love about it are the kind of the blind alleys that were not followed. The second EP has a track on it called Spending You, which sounds like something Jamin Lewis would have made, you know, or Skirty Politti, you know, and it doesn't sound like anything that we're doing around about it, but it's obviously we're just trying us out. And what I love about it, I love the kind of wellspring of creativity that happens all the way through it, almost at every stage, you know. So it's quite something to look back and think that you were, you know, at one point you were doing a gig in a forest and you were opening for Van Morrison, or at one point you're in the Louvre and you're opening for Ray Charles, or at one point, you know, you're going around a wind-strewn, hurricane-blasted Britain with Simply Red, you know. So it's worth getting it all down. And I sort of feel as if there's ever going to be a biographer or a PhD,
yeah,
you know, that we have provided, Gregory has provided the means for them to kind of look at what it means to sort of survive in the music business on the basis of being interested in creativity as much as, in fact, more than success, you know. So the point of actually doing it together is the point. You know, rather than, I mean, we could always do with more money, but I'm willing to work hard, and we do work hard as live musicians at the moment. But it seems to me the 40 years is telling me it's at the service of the next great idea, which is surely the best way to do it.
Yeah, and I guess for bands who are just starting out, even to see the highs and lows and the struggles and the successes and all of these things is pretty informative, I guess.
I think so. I'm expecting Dr. Gregory Kane at some point to be contacted, you know, by an academic department, you know. So I will be very pleased to see.
Well, there's nothing worse than being asked advice by a young, enthusiastic, hopeful musician. Greg, have you got any advice for me? So usually I get parents. And I said, don't do it. What do you mean, don't do it? Don't do it. Just don't do it. especially now. I mean, I was watching Rick Beato talk about the Super Bowl thing. That's why I sent there. You think that part of the Super Bowl halftime? Usher. Mm. Usher hasn't had a hit for 20 years.
I thought that was strange myself.
Very, very. But if you look at it, what of the new acts? Maybe Billie Eilish is probably the only one you would think is global enough of a new act. Mm-hmm. But her set's really melancholy. It's really somber. That wouldn't work.
Yeah, Lana Del Rey at the Super Bowl really wouldn't really work, would it?
Can you imagine all the lights and all the flares?
Yeah, I love it.
God, Oh, that would be great. Somebody with a sense of humor at the NFL should do that. That would be great. So, I mean, that's young band. It's all, I mean, it's all different. You don't get. It was a good question that Rick Beato posed, where he said, which new band would you put at halftime in the Super Bowl? Who would cut it?
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. And it just, that kind of depicts how the environment and has changed for musicians and where they make their music. I mean, I follow a lot of music makers who talk about making music. So a lot of tutorials, a lot of people who talk about the industry. But most of them, when you go on to listen to their music, it's not music that touches me or reaches out to me. It's very introverted. The music's sort of looking in rather than, we always try to look out. We always try to kind of, and do it with a bit of panache and a bit of style and a bit of intrigue and always kind of, what is it, less is more. Like, you know, more is more. That was the way we used to think. You know, it's more stuff is good, not less is more. So we never adhered to the less is more. But you're listening to the young musicians now, and no, not many people. I think the last band to look outwards is Coldplay, maybe. They're kind of a dance band, a rock band, rock dance band. They changed. Mm-hmm. Again, I was looking at, I found a ticket that had Coldplay at King Tut's in 1999. Yeah. It's nothing to do with Hue and Cry, but it was in a box. I was like, did I go and see Coldplay 1999 King Tut's? My goodness. I don't know why I'd get the ticket, but it was lying in the bottom of a box. So, I mean, yeah, I don't know what advice you would give. Well, I know, I'd just say to them, look, be prepared for a lot of hard work and a lot of disappointment. We were lucky that we shared all that. Imagine being a solo artist.
Yeah.
And having to deal with that. I mean, Pat and I could, you know, enjoy the highs together, and it was great celebrating together. But we kind of needed each other on the lows as well.
And I was going to ask, is that's kind of at the heart of the longevity, is the relationship between the two of you, that you were able to support each other through the good times and the bad times?
Yeah. Yeah, even from very, even early on. I mean, the great story there are many great stories, but, you know, the one where we're standing, Greenock Arts Guild, having just done a gig to show ourselves off to Seymour Stein,
right,
the guy who signed Madonna and Bruce Springsteen. And Seymour Stein saying, basically, you're good, you sound good, you look good, but you need someone else to help you with the songwriting. And my response to Seymour Stein is, what, the guy standing next to you with a black, with a leather tie with the black and white piano keys on it? You must be kidding. So that's you can look at that two ways. You look at that, you stupid, big-mouthed idiot. You know, or you can say, I looked at Gregory, I think, Gregory doesn't need anybody, I don't need anybody to write songs with. That's a Faustian pact. That's what doth it profit the world to gain the world and sell your soul, but, you know, lose your soul. Yeah. Call that arrogance, or just call that kind of fundamentally, no, we can write these songs, we can make these songs as good as they can be, we don't need help.
And so, is that part of the pride about looking back, is that you've done it on your own terms?
Yeah, I think so. What do you think, Greg?
I'm just trying to remember that. So Seymour Stein flew over from America to Greenock just to see us. I mean, you need to give it a bit more context, Pat.
Sure.
Coming over with a big flag to go, I want to make Hue and Cry and Pat Kane's voice a global phenomenon. And he brought over his wee songwriter that he thought, you're going to like these guys. You help them with their songs. This is going to be great. So the wee songwriter, God bless his soul, decided to wear a piano tie to one of our gigs. And he sat down and he never even got a word in. The first thing Pat said was, you in that fucking tie. There's no way I'm writing songs to you.
On such things, careers are made and broken.
That was it. Most time back to his hotel room, a manager tried to kind of, I don't know what he tried to do, apologise, and then Seymour Stein flew back to America. And
yeah, that was it.
Never thought of Hugh and Cry ever again.
And he's
if only we'd have not done that and maybe written some songs with the Piano Tie Guy, and then we might have met somebody else that the Piano Tie Guy, and then that might have worked, and then that might have led to that, and that might have led to that.
I could be sitting in a floral shirt in Los Angeles at the moment. You know.
A piano tie on.
With a piano tie on? No, a piano tie around my head.
Well, I've got a piano jacket in your piano room in your piano mansion, your piano tie driveway.
It's interesting, though, because that early success that you seem to... from the outside, it seemed that you got success with Seduced and Abandoned, and it was almost like instantaneous. I'm guessing it wasn't like that.
1982 is when the sort of archive starts.
Right.
I mean, Hugh and Cry are 40 years old from 1984, but previous to Hugh and Cry, we were in bands that recorded demos. Pat recorded with Midge Ure in London when he was 16. There was stuff going on before Hugh and Cry, but ultimately, when we got together as Hugh and Cry in 1984. I guess, yes, it was only, and 3 years later, Labour Love came out in June of 1987. So it was pretty quick.
Yeah.
You know, in those 2.5 years that we spent after we formed, we found a manager, we signed a publishing contract, we signed a record contract, we went to Los Angeles for photo sessions and made videos over there. We went to New York to finish our album that we started in Glasgow. We put a band together and we worked. It's the work rate, when you look back on it.
Yeah.
On episode 2, which is 1986, the video will go up at the end of the month. We're doing a kind of 12-episode documentary series. At the end of the video, I say to you, Pat, God, we flew back from Los Angeles in December after doing that photo session with Jean-Baptiste Mondino, and then we did a gig at the Limelight Club in front of New York producers. We must have been knackered, or we were much fitter back then.
Yeah, much better.
It's just the work rate. I couldn't believe the work rate. And then I think to myself, I've been working really hard on this for the last 6 months. I've been doing long days and long hours, and I've sacrificed seeing my partner, which has kind of affected our relationship, and I've sacrificed seeing my daughter, which has affected our relationship, because I couldn't. I was so focused on this because I didn't want to miss anything. Our fans are like... what's the guy? Not Clouseau. Who's the other one? Who's the English one?
Hercule Poirot.
Poirot, when it comes to...
Agatha Christie.
Agatha Christie when it comes to Hugh and Cry. Because everything has to be right. I've got about a dozen of these fans that kind of go, Greg, I think you'll find that fourth chord that you're playing now is not accurate. Could you maybe feel that? Really? My ball. So, yes, I need to be careful. So I've worked really, really hard on this. And then I was watching, I don't know if you guys know about Mr. Beast. You probably know about the Mr. Beast, the YouTube phenomenon.
Yeah.
No, I don't know that.
Right, so basically Mr. Beast, his videos get on average 300 million views. He's the biggest star in YouTube. Okay. And he's only 25 years old. And I've watched documentaries on him recently. And he said, I spent 4 years doing 15-hour days, 7 days a week. Say, how did you do this? How did you say this? I slept, I woke up and I started to do it. Slept, woke up, started to do it, and didn't stop. And then I put together people that I could talk to about how to do it better. I studied everything to do with YouTube. This is what I've been doing with Hugh and Cry, because I've got a workflow that I need to adhere to every morning, or I can't do it because there's too much stuff. There's 40 years you're trying to condense into 12 months. And you're trying to make sense of it, and you're trying to make it entertaining. You're trying to make it engaging, because it's one band, over 40 years career, and you're trying. You know, it's not easy. So feeling better, as Pat wrote once in one of her songs, you kind of fail a lot at this, but you learn.
Pat, you said something interesting earlier about how hard you're working, but also the music itself, because it struck me that you've always kind of changed. You know, there's been times where the jazz has been more to the front, or you've been soul, or you've done acoustic tours, or you've had full band and things like that. And is that to kind of challenge yourselves in the sense that Greg's now challenging himself to, you know, get all this stuff together? Was that, has that always been part of it?
You know, there's a Temptations track. What's the track? God, was it 1st of September, one day I'll always remember. Papa Was a Rolling Stone. Very influential song on me and Gregory.
Yep.
Funk scratch guitar, but also beautiful swirling orchestrations all around the song. Brilliant social message. I mean, it has everything. The song has everything. And so that's, there's a great phrase, was it Nelson Mandela said, God never thanks you for playing small. God never thanks you for playing small. So we've never played small. We brought out a record in 2017 called Pocket Full of Stones. And it's a beautiful record. Radio 2 didn't check for it, whatever. But it was a beautiful, and one of the most beautiful aspects of it was Gregory's orchestrations. So yeah. not only is the guy sitting there with the hoodie on and the technology and all the rest of it, he can sit down and write an orchestration that sounds like something like a classic from the last 300 years of classical, of orchestral music. You know, I mean, it's a joy to be alive and have that level of range.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and why not? And we get the same buzz from sitting listening to an arpeggiator that sounds like a quasar from the heart of a black hole, you know, which is what a lot of these synthesizers sound like. They're elemental waveforms, pulses of sound. That's not different from wanting an orchestra on your record. It's not different at all. It's just a different response to the same impulse, which is how can you make something stand the hairs up in the back of your neck or get the goosebumps up on your forearm, you know? So it's a kind of relentless eclecticism, which, as Gregory says, more is more. The better thing is not more is less, it's more is more. Because, I mean, you could go very, very, I can easily get very, very philosophical about it, you know, very. I mean, I'm 60, my father died at 78, mother died at 85, you know, it's the third act.
Yeah.
So I'm not really in the mood for my third act. I don't know if maybe I'll get a fourth act if the chemicals and the biogenetic engineering comes in to stop my cells degenerating. If that doesn't happen, this is the third act. And there's absolutely no way the third act isn't going to be more exciting than the first two acts, because so much has been learned, so many things have been tried. You don't go down that road, you know that road works. So musically, that can extend to all different parts of your life, but music is one of the best media for keeping yourself alive. What's the great phrase from Bob Dylan's Masters of War? He not busy being born is busy dying.
Mm.
He not busy being born is busy dying. You know, the point about life is to die only once, not every day, because you're not fulfilling and satisfying yourself. You know, so that's how philosophical I get about how this thing keeps going. You know, I'm so privileged to have looked into music and looked into my brother as a musician to keep myself alive, keep myself thriving and alive.
So this
Ta-da!
This is very much, it's 40 years taking that into account, but then we've got the next stage to come.
Next 40 years.
Yeah, we will all be brains and jars talking to each other. Zoom's a little bit like that anyway, but absolutely.
Or ABBA Voyage, who knows? I might be up for getting a full body scan, right? And given that I'm at my physical prime, you know, and then we can send out our beamed out 3D avatars in around about 2046.
And talking about live, you've always had a great reputation as a live band, as you've mentioned, for playing for all those reasons, and you're going to be touring. That's part of the celebrations as well. I think October and November you're going to be doing quite a big tour.
Yes, I mean, this all started because we had a meeting at the end of three quarters through last year about this tour, and everything else just sprung from that meeting. What a meeting that was. I hope Emma recorded that meeting, but all the other stuff the archive being put on Patreon, the four-track EP every month, the documentary, 12-episode documentary about the history of Hue and Cry. The meeting was only supposed to be this tour that was happening in October, November. And we tour October, November with a full band. And it is promoted as the 40th anniversary tour. Pat and I have been doing a lot of interviews recently, and the question has been posed to us, you know, what are you going to do? And, you know, I thought about, I've been answering that with, we should maybe reach out to the fans and see, what do they want? You know, what do you want us to do for you? We can do that. But I mean, it just dawned on me this morning when we were doing that interview. The last time we did that, there was an Uber fan who wanted us to come and play for him and his friends. And we said, yes, it was in London and Chelsea. It was all dead fancy. And he's like, Greg, do you mind if I send you what I want you to play? I says, I prefer if you send me what you want to play so nobody's disappointed. So he sent the list of the most obscure Hue and Cry songs. Probably, and Pat and I had rehearsed. It was, our fee was quite, you know, commanding. And we said, right, well, we'll honour it. And we practiced it. He brought in a jazz drummer, the drummer from Scottish National Jazz Orchestra. Aidan O'Donnell played bass on it. Aidan's one of the top guys in New York now. And we sat down and we started playing. And he put he sat down right in front of us at the gig, sitting watching it. And we cleared the fucking hall. It was only him that liked the songs. But he'd asked for it and he was paying for it. Everybody else was out in the balcony. And I was thinking, I was looking at the set list and there was no crowd pleasers in it. So we're not going to ask the fans, Pat.
No, probably.
It could be a complete disaster.
Yeah,
the B side of the drum and bass jazz bebop classic in the B side of that, yeah, not a good idea.
I think the thing that I want to try and incorporate, and we'll need to figure out what to do, is the luxury is to tour with a lighting engineer. That's the one, because it's slightly bigger venues we're playing, and it's pretty much sold out. I think there's about 18-20 gigs, and I think there's only about 200-300 tickets left.
Wow.
For the whole lot, if you know what I mean. So it's done really well. So I think if we can do the numbers, I'd like to talk to our management about visuals.
Yeah, and archive.
And all the archive stuff that I brought up, how do we incorporate that into the show? I mean, talking about the Super Bowl earlier on about Usher, all that's scripted and they're all mimes. I wonder if we should do some scripted bits of it, Pat. Dare I say theatrical? You know, is there an opportunity to do something like that? That's not. It's going to have. I don't know.
I think we can. We're going to integrate the audiovisual archive that Gregory's done. I think we have to do that. We have to think. We have to start thinking about that now. So I think it's going to be a bit of an immersive experience for people. You know. And we're going to have to invest in that and maybe try and get it filmed in its own right. But it's quite a challenge. And I think if we thought we could get away with a few hits, a few covers, and a few repeted hits again, I don't think that's going to work. Yeah. What I'd love to do, what we've always done live, I mean, I remember when we were playing the SEC, we would set up a gig, an acoustic gig in the middle of the crowd. You know, and so we'd always have that kind of big widescreen impact with the music, and then we'd always bring it down to. So I would love us to kind of. I think there are songs that we've done that are just so intimate and so quiet, and to put that, to have that in the context of the full band as well. So I think that's going to be quite intimate, loud memory. I think it's going to be kind of playing around with those kind of feels, I think. But it's going to be a deal. We're going to make it work.
That sounds great, absolutely. And do you listen to anyone new? You know, I play a lot of new Scottish music on the radio show and stuff, and I was wondering if there's anyone. What made me think of this question is because I think that jazz in Scotland, again, is having a bit of a moment, like it did when you guys were coming through, there was soul and jazz.
Yeah.
What's the bands covering it? Do you listen to any kind of modern representatives?
Yeah, I do like Becky Sakalis. I think she's doing some really good stuff. I like the big singer, Big Joseph. I think he's doing really interesting stuff. Yeah. And of course, Young Fathers won Scottish Album of the Year last year.
Yeah.
And then the year before that was Fergus McCready. Fergus McCready, the piano player, has been playing some amazing stuff.
Yeah.
So I've been involved in Scottish Album of the Year Awards for, my goodness, it must be over 10 years.
Right.
So I make all the video content and stuff like that of the long list and the short list. So as one of the directors said to me, Stu Henderson from the Delgados, he says, you must know everything about the Scottish music scene, editing all these videos every year. You did a long list, which is 20 artists, and the short list was just 10. I says, I suppose I do. I like Catherine Joseph. Catherine Joseph has been making some amazing music, and she's quite compelling to watch as well. You think when you hear that record and what it sounds like live, it might be a wee bit too introverted. It's not. It's really in your face live when she plays.
I saw it at Celtic Connections just recently, actually. And it was at Drygate, and it was an amazing, amazing night.
And then Chris Drever and all those guys, the folk scene. I mean, Celtic Connections is just finished.
Yep.
Here in Glasgow, and another incredibly successful year. Donald Shaw's done amazing with it.
The guy called C. Duncan, Chris Duncan.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing music. That's utterly amazing music. He has the sensibility of a Brian Wilson, you know? And I could listen. His music heals me. Right. If I'm feeling bad.
Yeah.
Feeling depressed or despairing, the guy gets me out of a trough. I mean, I think he's one of these people who, if there was such a thing as a genius grant, you would just give him the money and say, go to a beautiful castle at the edge of an Italian lake, and here's an orchestra on tap. Just go and do your thing for 12 months. So him, definitely. But Fergus MacCready, genius young man. He once played in a version of Labour of Love, actually. That's in the archive somewhere. Let's see if we can dig that out. And then another band that I really regret their passing, and I don't know what's happened to them all now, is a band called Pronto Mama,
who
brought out a song called Arabesque, which is the best thing I've heard from a Scottish band in 20 years. It's Scottish accent, singing like the Proclaimers. They sound like Frank Zappa.
Yeah.
You know, this drummer is wild. The virtuosity is high. I mean, I just, when that record came out, I thought, there's another wave of the Scottish pop about to happen. And unfortunately, I don't know what happened to them. They just kind of fell apart, or they didn't gather the momentum required. But yeah, Gregory has been involved. The Scottish Albums of the Year Award, the thing. We're often very down on ourselves in Scotland. We're doomed. We think that things don't work. We think that we can't get things together. And we do not celebrate the things that work. So Celtic Connections really works. The Scottish Album of the Year, which was supported by the music business, by the government, by all these interfering busybodies, so people assuming that they have authority to do something, this will never work. It bloody works.
Yeah,
and you listen every time you get to the Album of the Year long list.
Yeah,
I mean the short list. It's just this picture of a country in which people have ideas pouring out of their orifices all the time, you know, and they've got to find a way to make it happen, and they make it happen. And I think it's as a positive sign of the quality of Scottish life. I think things like Celtic Connections and the Scottish Album of the Year are to be. I'm here. I'll celebrate them if nobody else will, rather than people being complacent about them or thinking, oh, we need something better than that. Who dare we think we are to kind of come up with a concept like a Scottish Album of the Year or Celtic Connections? Who dare we think we are? To hell with that.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And yeah, I went to quite a few things at Celtic Connections this year, and everyone was absolutely stunning, you know.
Yeah.
Andrew Vaslick in a Macintosh church. It wasn't just the bands, it was the venues. It's just done so, so well. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
So, but just before we say cheerio, where can people find your Patreon and where can people find the documentaries? You know, it's all, is there a one-stop shop that people can go to?
You can go to the Hue and Cry Facebook page, which seems all kind of emanates from there. There's a hueandcry.co.uk, which you can go to. And Patreon is patreon.com/hueandcry. Come and have a look.
Fantastic. Guys, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I really do appreciate it. And all the best on your anniversary.
All right, man. Thank you.
Do you know what I've realised, Pat? It's a Ruby anniversary. And do you know what song should play?
Yes.
You do?
Oh. What should we play? What?
I've got a girl and Ruby.
I've got a girl and Ruby is her name. She don't love me, but I love her all the same. Yes, yes. Let's do it.
I was thinking, Ruby, don't take your love to town. That's what I was.
You're not getting in with our band, Alistair. No.
You started off so well, Alistair, asking the question that's never been asked.
I'm blowing it. I'm blowing it at the end. No, thanks very much, guys. And we'll be back soon with someone completely different.